Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 314 of Registry Matters. Larry, what's up?
The temperature, 100.
Just 100?
That's all.
You know, they did say this whole global warming thing was a big pile of poo-poo.
I agree. It's all liberal lefty scare tactics. That's all it is.
Chance, how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm good in this liberal lefty state. It's really nice. Sun's out. Weather's beautiful.
Larry, what
sorry about that, Larry.
What do your right-wing nutjob people call it?
Call what?
What do they call California?
Oh, they have so many names.
Don't they have a really nasty pejorative?
It's, you know, talking about the Californicators and stuff like that.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, I know.
Would you tell me what we're doing tonight? We'll just dive right in, Larry. What are we doing tonight?
We have a case from the Missouri Supreme Court, and it didn't go well for the PFR community. And we have a brief follow-up from last week's episode regarding banishment. We got a submission from someone, and he used an old email address I don't look at very often, but I happened to look at it. So next time, I'm going to suggest he use a different email address, which I'll send him. We have an update about an ongoing case that's out of Alabama, and it was argued and heard before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. And Chance is back with us this week. So we have a press release from the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, lawyers, and I'm going to give him grief about it. It's about Marcy's Law. And then we will have a California corner. And I don't know what that California corner is about. What's that California corner you got tonight? What are you talking about, Chance?
About progress. Progress in parole. Progress in treatment. Good news for folks who want to finish off their treatment and get off of parole. Good news.
All right. Well, that's what we've got going. And I deleted all the articles because I think with all this content, we'll have enough to cover a sufficient amount of time, and I'm trying to shorten these episodes. Hint, hint.
I don't know who you're talking about, man. All right. No, of course not. I do know. All right. Well, then let's go and move right into this first segment. And this is from, this is the one that you said came into a funky email address. Came into my funky email address, too. It says, thank you for the talk about the North Carolina case that we covered last week, but I'm a little confused by your definition of banishment. You claim, Larry, listen, you claim that the original meaning of the term in colonial times is not consistent with today's residency restrictions as applied ex post facto. What is your basis for this claim? Larry, the answer would be is you were there when they wrote it, right?
Good point.
Yeah, all right, Larry banishment, was there.
He was. Banishment is a very old term and appears, for example, in the famous novel, The Scarlet Letter, in which Hester is banished to the edge of town. She's not forced to leave the colony. I understand that several U.S. states distinguish between intrastate and interstate banishment, but both are considered punishment, are they not?
Well, it's a good question, and the way when I discussed banishment, I'm not giving my definition. I'm giving the definition as it has evolved through decades, millennia of jurisprudence. And I was tying it to original interpretation. And I've got this link that we're going to make available that gives people a little bit more information on the history of banishment. But my key point was that banishment, as defined by the courts, means to prohibit a person's presence. And whether it doesn't have to be statewide, but the argument that was being put forth in that challenge was that the PFRs were being banished, and their own mapping expert testified, or at least presented evidence, that the range of exclusions were anywhere from like 42% to like 48.9% in the three largest cities in North Carolina. That means that over half of all the housing stock available is open to PFRs, which means under that type of interpretation, they have not been banished. They have not been told to leave Raleigh or Durham or one of the large cities that were mentioned in that. There was Charlotte, and I forget the other city, but they have the opportunity to live and be present, conduct commerce. That's not the same as banishment was understood back in those days. As he points out, the person was banished to the edge of town. But that's what, under North Carolina law, they're not ordered to leave town and never return. In fact, the record showed that they're permitted to reside in more than half of the state's three largest cities. Those who believe in original interpretation would and should be proud of the ruling, because nobody has been banished, as the word banishment was understood in colonial times. And I was making that point with a little tongue-in-cheek. A lot of our audience proclaims that they are originalists. They're textualists and these various iterations of being admirers of Justice Scalia and similar justices. And you should be happy when a ruling like this comes down, because Justice Scalia would be very proud that nobody tried to legislate from the bench. They did not do anything other than look at banishment as it was understood in colonial times. And they said, there's no banishment here. Over half of all this housing stock in these three large cities is available for a vendor. So nobody's been banished.
I recall when Paul Dubling put the map up on the screen at, I don't remember which conference it was, but it showed all the big circles of where they can and can't be. I do recall that one of them went over, maybe there's like a child daycare at like the voting office or the place where you go testify, the state capitol, something like that. So like you're not allowed to go to the state capitol. And I recall you saying something of the effect, I'll be damned if I'm not going to go redress my grievances with the government. That's a First Amendment thing right there.
Well, I'm not good on the amendments, but it's a basic constitutional and fundamental right that you have to seek redress in a democratic society. Even if you're not a voter, this is a misunderstanding for so many people. Even if you don't vote, you can still have grievances against the government, and you're permitted to participate in the process. When you go into a legislative session, they don't ask you if you're a voter. They don't ask you if you're a voter ID card. They don't do any of those things, because lawmakers represent everyone. They represent convicted felons who are barred. They represent people who are in prison. They represent people who are confined to the mental institutions. They represent school children. They represent a lot of non-voters. They're the spokesperson for everybody. So I would be very hesitant to honor that law. If I felt like I couldn't go to the Capitol, I would almost want to make a point I damn well can go to the Capitol. And I'd align myself with some resources if I had the ability, and I would go, and I'd let the chips fall as they, let the chips fall as they may.
How about, is there a legal definition of banishment? Maybe Chance?
I don't think so. I haven't ever thought about that. I mean, I'd have to research that, actually.
I think if we compare it to with like 2,500 foot restrictions, maybe in Florida, where with circles drawn that big around all kinds of things that they do in Florida, that you end up with these tiny little pockets where that tent city is that they cover in the Untouchables, is where all the circles, the Venn diagram goes around, and there's this industrial park where there's so little of anything around it that they've set up a tent encampment, but then they go raid the tent encampment. That's not the part I'm really talking about. But they're far enough out of the way of everything that that's the only place that they can effectively be. By comparison with what Paul Dubling put up, is like 50% of the town is unavailable, but that still leaves you the other 50%, something like that. I did this same sort of thing in Georgia of trying to figure out where I could go target, trying to figure out where I could live with the 1,000-foot restrictions in Georgia. And sure, you draw a 1,000-foot circle around every church, school, daycare, and stuff. There's still huge swaths of area where you can live. There might not be houses there, but you're not banished.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's probably technically correct. I mean, the whole idea of a culmination of all these things is banishment. I mean, let's be honest. Intellectually, we could parse these things, but the fact is that there are so many levels to banishment. And, you know, in order to really come to a firm definition, it'd be like playing 3D chess. We'd have to look at it in so many different ways. I mean, what's the sum total of all of it? It's really social banishment. And it really is done in so many other ways. But we're talking here about physical banishment. And sometimes, you know, you're pushed to the limit. You actually are pushed to the edge of town or to a little hole or to a little place under a bridge. And, you know, that's pretty much what the sum total of it is.
True, Chance. But the point I'm trying to make with people is that if you're really proud of your conservative interpretation, judicial philosophy, and you should be happy with these outcomes because this is in alignment with a conservative approach to interpreting the Constitution. If you're a believer in originalism, like Scalia and many people that like to assimilate with him, say that, you know, he's my type of judge, then this would make your heart race ahead because this is great stuff. If you believe in the evolving standards of decency, which was something that was coined under the leadership of Chief Justice Earl Warren, then you would have to elect people who will appoint different type of justices to the Supreme Court and to the courts of appeals around the country. This is a rational interpretation. I'm not knocking Scalia. I'm just saying that this is in alignment with that type of interpretation. If you vote for these people, don't be shocked when they put this type of person in judicial office, because the presidents appoint the federal trial judges, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court justices. The only part of the federal judiciary that's not appointed by the president is the magistrate judges. But everything else requires a presidential appointment.
Yeah, I think you'd be correct there. And in that interpretation, certainly.
Moving along then.
Okay.
Well, we have, let's see here. I have this link to refer people to more information. Oh, wait, this is still from his letter. Is that correct? Or is that what you just talked about?
No, we're finished. We're going on to the NACTL news release.
I got you. Okay, sorry. I saw that as a separate segment. Then you have this news release that you want to discuss, and it states, new report from Nation's Criminal Defense Bar outlines how Marcy's Law undermines the criminal legal system. I can't wait to hear this. I saw TV commercials with Kelsey Grammer, the guy that played Frasier, talking about how we need to have Marcy's Law and give victims rights and blah, 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 back when they were trying to push this through.
Well, my sinister motivation is twofold. First, I want to poke at Chance a little bit because this stems from California, I think, originally. But also, I want to try to illuminate for people who just, they want so bad for NARSL to work with the victims' organizations. We are not on the same team. We sit on opposite sides of the courtroom. They're trying to put you in a cage. We're trying to keep you out of the cage. Would that be a fair assessment, Chance?
Yes, that would be a fair assessment. Correct. Yes.
So get over it. We're not on the same team. But anyway, the article states, quote, a new report from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, NACTL, outlines the ways in which Marcy's Law, the colloquial name for the Model Victims Bill of Rights, undermines fundamental due process rights. I couldn't help myself because Chance is here. The article states that Marcy's Law was first passed in California in 2008 and now adopted in 12 states. Marcy's Law enshrines victims' rights within state constitutions.
Come on, Larry. You have to think that this is something that would be good. So what's your beef with this?
Well, the article actually eloquently identifies my beef. The article states, at a fundamental level, the law has subverted the role of the criminal legal system and conflated prosecutors' responsibility to the state with an untenable responsibility to individual victims. Marcy's Law expands the definition of a victim and the scope of victimhood, and its provisions include the right to notification, the right to be heard, the right to privacy, and the right to restitution. In my opinion, victims are mere witnesses in a criminal proceeding. They do not own the case. The case is the people of the state of California or the people of the state of Maryland. You are a mere witness in the proceeding, and they have bestowed too many rights on the victims. That is my beef.
The report, which is authored by would that be Rachel or Rochelle? I guess it's Rochelle. Any thoughts?
Not sure. All right.
Yep, that's it.
All right. So Rochelle Powers and Jacqueline Berkeley finds that, among other impacts, these provisions waste valuable system resources, delay proceeding and interfere with appropriate case disposition, reduce access to critical discovery and testimony, limit police accountability, and create untenable restitution conditions for defendants. Can you highlight the key findings there, please, sir?
Sure. According to the report, rights attach at the point of victimization, implying an accused person who should be presumed innocent to prove them guilty is now presumed guilty. Marcy's Law prioritizes speedy outcomes and convictions over the administration of justice. The right of a victim to refuse disclosure of relevant documents and pretrial interviews hampers the ability of defense attorneys to investigate. Now, Chance can definitely relate to that. A defendant's financial situation is no longer considered in restitution, creating financial burdens that increase collateral consequences. The expansion of who is considered a victim, the requirements to notify the victim of all proceedings, and the right for the victim to be heard and confer with the prosecution has overburdened the legal system. And again, that is my beef, because you are a witness. This is not your case. Anyway, Chase, you can jump in here as a defense attorney if you want to, you know, about how this impairs your practice, if it does.
Well, I would agree with the report's findings. I've never agreed with Marcy's Law. It really emanated out of law enforcement and the district attorney's office. I do know who helped write it. I would agree with the report's findings, especially access to an effective defense. I mean, Marcy's Law allows for the victim to refuse any pretrial interviews, depositions, and disclosure of relevant documents, including medical and psychological records that establish injury as a result of victimization and other exculpatory evidence. As the report states, without this evidence, defense attorneys are not able to fully investigate the case. You've said it. Court says it. Everybody says it. I also believe that these restrictions impede a defendant's right to effective assistance of counsel, which is a potential Sixth Amendment violation. I do think it's of constitutional magnitude.
Hey, Larry, can I just kind of jump in and ask a question? Wouldn't this fly in the face of what Scalia had said about you have a right to face your accuser, whatever that whole thing was about?
In my opinion, yes. And I give Scalia credit on that area. He was one of the strongest in terms of the confrontation clause of any justice that comes to mind. But it makes it impossible for us to do our jobs on the defense side when the doors are shut by a constitutional amendment that the voters have adopted, and we can't. I had an advocate a year or so ago, a case was won in Connecticut or someplace up in the Northeast, and she said, just goes to show you've got the courage to take these cases to trial. And I looked at the case and I saw all the things that they did. I said, we would never be allowed to do those things here. We would never be allowed to do that. So, but anyway, I agree with NACDL President Christopher Wellborn, who stated, while victims deserve to be treated with compassion and dignity, Marcy's Law puts the needs of victims above those of the accused, limiting the constitutional mandate of a robust defense, upending the notion of innocent unless proven guilty, and prioritizing victims' desired case outcomes over true justice. Remember, the tie goes to the accused. We would rather, 100 go free than an innocent person be put in jail. The person who is going to be put in the cage is the one who we have to protect most of all, because that cage is hard to open if they're put in it unjustly and incorrectly. It's very hard to undo a conviction. Chance, would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I certainly would, strongly. And I hold the same position.
So
The NACDL executive director Lisa Wayne stated, "Marcy's law is fundamentally incompatible with constitutional principles of fairness." She went on to say, "Our system affords individuals charged with crimes constitutional protections against the powers of the government. Measures which erode these protections impact every facet of our criminal legal system, leading to increased use of pretrial detention, lack of confidentiality for juvenile defendants, more collateral consequences associated with convictions, limited parole opportunities, and wrongful convictions. They mire the state in administrative bureaucracy, delaying trials, imposing financial burdens, and wasting taxpayer dollar. We therefore call on the public and elected officials to oppose Marcy's law." I gotta think that you are going to agree with that, even though you're Mr. I don't agree with anything. But do you?
I do actually agree fully with that, both NACDL officials, and give them kudos for issuing the statement. And see, I think Chance kind of agrees right as well, right?
I do. I mean, this is the
organization that would be lobbying for this kind of thing. That's, you know, they're in this camp.
But at least they're saying it. Everybody rolls over when it comes to Marcy's Bill, Victims Bill of Rights and stuff. The lawmakers, they hear these tearful testimonials in the legislature about something bad that happened. And bad things do happen to people. People get victimized. And the system breaks down. And cases fall through the cracks. And things that are very frustrating happen. But at the end of the day, our commitment as a society is to keep innocent people from being put behind bars until we have that proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if we make it so that you can't put on a robust defense, then you can convict anybody.
And what do you say to the advocate? I know who you're referring to in the other one. But then, I don't know, wasn't it 6 months ago that someone called you to the mat on this thing? And he was like, "Well, I'm not supporting you guys anymore because you don't support victims' advocacy." But what do you say to the idea that this person on the, that is essentially a witness, is part of the case now, that has had something bad happen to them? What do you say to them that they've had a wrong done and justice needs to be served, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Like, don't we need to have some compassion and thought for them in the process too?
Well, we do. We treat them with kindness, and we convey that we're sorry as a society that something bad happened to them. But we don't even assume that we shouldn't assume that something bad happened. I know it's a shocker to some, but people make false accusations.
What?
We have to validate the veracity of the allegation, which is one of the things that's taken away from us. We're supposed to assume that any assertion made by someone is true. And that's ridiculous.
Flawed mortals. It is. It is ridiculous.
Make false accusations. Go ahead, Chance.
Well, yeah, it's all those protections are built into the system anyway. I mean, there's all kinds of things that can be done to protect victims without impeding on the constitutional rights of defendants. The balance is struck in and of itself. This is a hack to really disable the defense in cases involving Marcy's Law. And victims, you know, Bill of Rights is kind of a hack to get around a person's full enjoyment of their Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And it's great that so few states buy into this, but for those states who do, it's a problem.
We've managed to prevent it from passing here, but it comes up almost every session. And they're very powerful because the testimony they put on is very emotional. It's hard to have 112 lawmakers looking and saying, "We're going to vote no on this," when you've got all these people that are boo-hooing about how they've been screwed over and the system doesn't care about their rights. And I'm saying, well, wait a minute. You really don't have any rights under the Constitution. You are a witness. But Larry, I was victim. You are a witness. And they just get crazy when I tell them, "You are a witness in a criminal proceeding." Have I missed anything, Chance? Is a victim anything more than a witness?
Well, yeah, they are a witness. And if they need certain protections, the protections are built in. You can protect them. There are all kinds of orders that can be done. They get their say. When a person's sentenced, they make an impact statement. There's all kinds of things they get anyway. Those are built in. This is just over the top. You don't need this. This is a hack.
Let me ask one more question, probably more directed at you, Chance. When you go into the courtroom and you are afforded the opportunity to cross-examine, don't you kind of have to play, in certain circumstances, you don't have to play hardball, but in certain circumstances, you may have to play hardball to get the person to trip up on their statement to create the level of doubt?
Well, certainly you do. It, you have to shift gears, and sometimes you have to play hardball and sometimes you don't. But even before you get the chance to do it, if you're limited in what you know, how are you going to know what to do? How are you going to know how to defend? How are you going to know where to go in your cross? Where are the weaknesses? What do you exploit? You're kind of crippled when you go to cross-examine in the first place. How do you do that?
And the question frequently comes up about this particular part of if you are going to challenge them on the statements that have been made, the accusations that have been made, then you're re-victimizing them by having them go over it again. But how would you be able to do this and maybe expose weaknesses in the story, flaws, without having them go back over it?
Yeah, that is a huge problem. I have to say, though, that, you know, in cases I've been involved with, I really haven't seen the assertion here too much of these things. In California, we've kind of ironed these things out, you know, so that they don't really impede in these in trials. And we have, you know, that's why I'm looking at this. And when I read it, you know, it bothers me. But it bothers me in a different way, because it has kind of bled into post-conviction, you know, which is where it does not belong, if anywhere. And, you know, that it's just, it's in a place now where it's totally disconnected, but judges think it's law and can apply it at any phase. And it's not relevant in post-conviction.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, let's move over to this courthouse news article that you put in here from the 11th Circuit of Appeals. And it states a panel of the 11th Circuit judges seemed unconvinced on Tuesday that Alabama should be allowed to reinstate an unequivocal ban on child PFRs living with their parents. And what's this about?
We discussed this back in January on RM episode 289. The case is Henry versus Abernathy. Bruce Henry wants to live under the same roof as his young son. Imagine that. But he's bound by Alabama Code 15-20A-11, subsection D4. That says no adult PFR shall reside or conduct an overnight visit with a minor, including the offender's own children, if the PFR has been convicted of any offense involving a child. And I'm assuming that child is defined as anyone under 18. The law automatically applies to cases like Henry's without a hearing, imposing a lifetime non-appealable ban on living with one's own children based solely on the fact of a qualifying conviction. And that's what was written in the brief.
You know, I have a lot of very distasteful jokes about the age that they would call a minor in Alabama versus the age of marriage, so to speak. You know, Larry, I read it. Okay, this is completely off the rails. But I read an article recently about that. I think there are three states in the United States that there's no minimum age of marriage.
No. Could be, but that's also changing. There's a move to make sure that, I mean, the victims' advocates are trying to bust up the holy matrimony of marriage and make sure that that only certain people can get married.
I know, but can you imagine you're five and you're getting married?
Yeah, but nobody ever did that. You're being silly.
But there's at least, anywho. All right, so anyway, that was just a little bit of a tangent. Sorry. All right, and then in January of 2024, U.S. District Court Judge R. Austin Huffacher? That's a terrible name. And a Donald Trump appointee agreed. He issued a memorandum and order partly granting Henry's summary judgment and declaring the law facially unconstitutional. The judge enjoined the state from enforcing the law as it was written. Sorry, I don't want to say that again because it sounds way too like a set of characters in the movie Meet the Parents.
So the case is now before a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit. The state is fighting tooth and nail. Alabama Solicitor General Edmund LaCour insisted Huffacher's injunction was unconstitutional and ignored the state's interest in trying to prevent these harms occurring to children, both by punishing those offenders who are caught and by preventing that harm from happening in the first place. That sounds like a bunch of hyperbole, but that is your Alabama Solicitor General making that argument.
U.S. Circuit Judge Robin S. Rosenbaum, a Barack Obama appointee, almost immediately interjected that few could argue against preventing or punishing child abuse. But Rosenbaum said the statute seemed to be both over-inclusive and under-inclusive, and crucially, there is no exit door. Judge Rosenbaum stated, there are so many ways that this could have been tailored better to avoid this problem. Do you agree, Larry?
I do. Also, U.S. Circuit Judge Nancy Abudu, a Joe Biden appointee, questioned the law's logic that while offenders can't be alone overnight with a minor child, they can have unsupervised visitation between 1 and 4 p.m. Now, you got to admit, that's funny. Judge Abudu stated, we know nationally, generally, that child abuse happens all times of the day. She asked, how does this provision in the statute protect a child during the daytime hours from being assaulted? The answer is, it doesn't, she said.
One second.
Wow.
Solicitor LaCour acknowledged problems with the law, but he added that Huffacher's injunction also prohibits the state from applying the law against any parents, no matter how egregious their offense.
Well, U.S. Circuit Judge on the panel also, Charles Wilson, a Bill Clinton appointee, said that Huffacher's order emphasized the unconstitutional nature of the lifetime ban without a hearing. LaCour also argued the law was narrowly tailored, God, I'd like to hear that argument, and supported by evidence that the sex offenders are likely to reoffend. But he conceded that the district court may have been correct with some of its findings. LaCour stated, at a minimum, this board, I think he means this panel, needs to reverse to the extent that the injunction applies to non-parents. He said that to the three-judge panel. There's no basis whatsoever to apply the injunction and prohibit us from applying the law to people who have no parental rights at all. Mr. Henry brought this only as a parental rights challenge. Now, he might have a point on that. I'll give that to him. If it's only about parental rights, then grandparents and everybody else are not involved in it.
Henry's attorney, Paul M. Dubling, said the issue is not whether convicted PFRs have a constitutional right to live with their children. Rather, he said the state has other methods to protect minors. He said the law at issue simply does not pass strict scrutiny.
He did say that, but Judge Wilson asked Dubling to defend his facial challenge of the law using the standard set in United States versus Salerno, which requires a challenger to meet a high burden that under no set of circumstances would the statute be valid. Now, we did in pre-show, Salerno was a challenge to the Bail Reform Act of 1984, and I think the U.S. Supreme Court decided Salerno in 87, and they established that standard that no set of circumstances is what it takes to win a facial invalidation.
How did Dubling respond to the question?
Dubling said, in the 35 years since Salerno was decided, no court has taken that language and said that the existence of a hypothetically valid application of the statute would relieve the state of its burden under the means-end analysis of strict scrutiny. He disagreed that the law could be warranted in some circumstances. Dubling said the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized a 14th Amendment right to care, custody, and control of one's children, as well as a First Amendment right of association to cohabitate with one's relatives. I think he's a little bit over the top, but that's what he said.
Judge Abudu said, it doesn't seem like there is any room, if someone has been convicted of a PFR-type crime, for their rights to be stripped away. She noted the Supreme Court has found that convicted felons can lose the right to own firearms, vote, and run for office in some cases. But what about that?
Well, Dubling agreed with that, but he added, there's no sanction in Supreme Court precedent for taking away a fundamental right of a family of First Amendment value based on the status of a felon. And I'm not sure I know what that means, but he said the remedy for a statute that fails strict scrutiny is facial invalidation of the statute. And I definitely don't agree with that. Dubling said in this case, it is legislature that needs to go back and decide how to handle this.
Do you think that the 11th Circuit will uphold the trial court?
I certainly hope they do, and I believe they will. But unfortunately, under the standards of Salerno, it makes it almost impossible for them to not to have some doubt. And if there's no set of circumstances that this could be a valid imposition by the state of Alabama, I think everybody tacitly admitted there might be a PFR type of offender where their parental rights could be legitimately terminated. But my answer to that, before I get on with the rest of my script here, would be that you need to go through that process of terminating their parental rights. There is a process, and I'm sure Alabama has it, as backwards as they are. There's a process for taking away children. You know, you have something that we call children, youth, and families, which you have some sort of child protective services that would come in and take away the children. So my argument would have been that there's a process to do that already. But anyway, the standard for facial and constitutional is that there's no set of circumstances that a law could be valid. Dubling appears to have conceded that, and that there may be circumstances where this would be constitutional. This could mean a loss on the facial invalidation that he won at the trial court, and it may be that the case gets remanded for an as-applied constitutional challenge analysis. And that's probably something Chance could get in and dig a little deeper than I've done, but I think there is some wiggle room for them to return this case and not affirm the trial court.
Yeah, perhaps. But, you know, that concession's pretty big.
I can think of a scenario where I don't think you would find very many people would disagree with removing someone's parental rights. I'm just going to say the name Nancy Yates. And if you don't know who that is, go look up the news because it's horrible. But I believe that most people would agree that under that kind of circumstances, it would be appropriate to remove a person's parental rights. Would you all agree?
We would agree with that. I know who you're talking about. But the problem that we have here is this is a statutory deprivation without any due process. It's a categorical determination based on the conviction. And Mr. Dubling is asserting that it's facially unconstitutional. There may be a tad bit of wiggle room there because under that analysis of Salerno, there has to be no set of circumstances where this could be validly done. There are circumstances where it could be validly done. It would be rare ones like Yates and like some extreme cases, but I would have wanted to have argued that those processes already exist. There's a process to remove children. We don't need it to be in the PFR statute. There's already a robust process to take away children.
I get you. Yeah, I just want to make sure that it was, there are circumstances where I think most people would agree, but this is the difference of it just being that the lawmaker said, if you get convicted of this crime, this is one of the side effects of it that you are not allowed to be around your children. And that's how it is in Georgia, that's part of probation, or is that part of the statute? That's one of the special conditions of probation.
Yeah, it's not a registration prohibition. This is a part of state statute for applying to registrants. It's crazy, but a lot of stuff crazy comes out of Alabama. But remember, Southerners think of themselves as being far more sophisticated, and they have far more common sense than the rest of the country, and they pride themselves on their brilliance.
Somebody told me that more presidents have been elected from the South than the North, Larry.
And that's what I'm telling you. They're smarter than the rest of the country.
Very well. Well, you have this case from the Missouri Supreme Court, and it's John Doe versus Eric T. Olson, number SC 100020. What is all this hoopla about?
Well, John Doe appealed the circuit court's judgment, that's a trial level court in Missouri, finding that the registration requirements of Missouri's Sex Offender Registry Act, we'll call it MOSORA, do not violate Mr. Doe's substantive due process rights or the prohibition on the ex post facto laws in Missouri.
Now, in the opening paragraph, the decision states, because Doe has no fundamental right to privacy in the information the registry requires him to disclose, and the registry is rationally related to the legitimate state interest of protecting children, the registry does not violate Doe's substantive due process rights. Because the registration requirements are civil in nature, the registry does not violate the prohibition on ex post facto law. Right out of the gate, I can see that this did not go well.
It did not. The Missouri Supreme Court affirmed the circuit court's judgment.
Do you mind if I set this up on how this all started?
I think that would be helpful because this case goes back for decades.
So back when you were a child, so this is in 1997. I'm just kidding. You were way, way older than a child in 97. Doe pleaded guilty to two Class C felonies, deviant sexual assault in the first degree and sexual assault in the first degree. The circuit court suspended Doe's sentence and placed him on probation for 5 years. And Doe registered as a PFR pursuant to the MOSORA. And then in 2002, Doe completed his probation requirements and the circuit court sealed Doe's criminal case records pursuant to the Missouri law, which closed his official case records because imposition of sentence was suspended and the case was finally terminated. Doe has remained on the PFR list since his guilty plea. And this is, that's really old.
It is. And the registry has been amended numerous times since then. The legislature amended MOSORA several times, imposing more onerous registration reporting requirements. Doe had finally had enough. In 2022, he filed his third amended petition for declaratory and injunctive release against the St. Louis County Sheriff and the Missouri Highway Patrol Superintendent seeking removal from the PFR registry. Doe claimed that the amendments to MOSORA after his plea required him to disclose information from a sealed record, which infringes on his rights to privacy and substantive due process, violation of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 10. Also the Missouri Constitution. Doe also claimed that the amendments render MOSORA punitive ex post facto law in violation of the 14th Amendment and Article 1, Section 9 of the United States Constitution and a similar provision in the Missouri Constitution.
Doe argued he has a fundamental right to privacy in information MOSORA requires him to disclose because the records relating to his criminal case were sealed by the circuit court. How did that go?
Not well. They stated, this court previously addressed a similar due process challenge to the registry. While this court generally acknowledged the right to privacy as fundamental, it ultimately found that petitioning PFRs whose records have not been sealed have no fundamental right to privacy and information already in the public domain. Doe freely admitted his guilt in open court and information contained in the record was public for 5 years prior to being sealed. Sealing a record does not prevent information related to the convictions from remaining in the public domain. The circuit court sealing the record does not nullify the historical fact. Doe has no fundamental right to privacy and information contained in his sealed records. Can you at least admit that this is funny?
This is not funny. This is the opposite of funny. So Doe claimed MOSORA violates the constitutional prohibition on ex post facto laws. The United States and Missouri Constitution both prohibit ex post facto laws. A constitutionally prohibited ex post facto law is one that provides for punishment for an act that was not punishable when it was committed or that imposes an additional punishment to that in effect at the time the act was committed. Now, what burden, I guess it would be burden of proof. What does he have to do to prove this?
Well, it's Doe's burden to show the law is unconstitutional. And they cited a case, Sanders, 168 Southwest 3rd at 68. the registration statutes will be upheld unless they clearly undoubtedly violate constitutional limitations. So it's a pretty heavy lift.
The court then stated, a two-stage inquiry determines whether a retrospective statute constitutes an invalid ex post facto punishment or a valid, non-punitive civil regulation. The first stage of the inquiry examines the intent of the statute. If registration statutes were intended to establish a punishment, the inquiry ends and ex post facto violation is established. If the registration statutes are intended to establish a non-punitive civil regulatory system, the inquiry proceeds to a determination of whether the registration statutes are sufficiently punitive in effect so as to negate the General Assembly's intent to enact a non-punitive civil PFR registration program. They always get past the first stage, though. What's the second stage of the process?
But during the second stage of the inquiry, because they're always going to determine the legislature intended to be remedial and not punitive, to determine if Mosora is civil or punitive, the court must analyze the five factors. And those factors, you've heard many times, the Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez factors. And there's actually seven, but this court, like so many, are just looking at five. And they are whether the registration requirements have been regarded in our history and traditions as punishment, whether the registration requirements promote the traditional aims of punishment, whether the registration requirements impose an affirmative disability restraint, my favorite, whether the registration requirements have a connection to a non-punitive purpose, and whether the requirements are excessive with respect to that non-punitive purpose.
Doe alleges amendments made to MOSORA after this court's holdings in Sanders have substantially changed the registration requirements, rendering MOSORA punitive on violation on the prohibition against ex post facto law. Doe takes issue with the following changes: redefining the classification of offenses, requiring tier 3 offenders to register for life, mandating 90-day reporting, requiring reporting in person to disclose any changes in registration information, mandating offenders to provide a DNA sample, adding requirements to the information offenders must disclose, and publishing more information about offenders online. What did the court hold on the first factor? And that's whether the registration requirements have been regarded in our history and traditions as punishment.
Well, they decided MOSORA may now require in-person reporting every 90 days and in-person reporting to make amendments to information on the registry. But these amendments are not so significant as to physically confine or constrain the movement of Doe akin to traditional punishment, such as incarceration or probation. This court finds MOSORA's registration requirements so distinguishable from traditional notions of punishment. Now remember, if you are an originalist and you believe what you say you believe, you would be applauding this, because traditionally punishment in colonial times was not viewed as these administrative things. Punishment was thought of putting someone in jail. There wasn't even probation in colonial times, much less all this civil regulatory scheme. So if you believe in literal, textual, and original interpretation, this should make you very happy.
So then on the second factor, though, the traditional aims of punishment, what did the court conclude with that arrangement there?
Well, very similar. The MOSORA imposes longer registration requirements on registrants based on the severity of the offense, but they said these requirements are reasonably related to the danger of recidivism. While MOSORA may serve the traditional aims of punishment, these aims are related to to regulatory objectives. So that one, they got shot down. So two out of five are already dead.
And the next one is your favorite. What do they conclude regarding affirmative disability and restraint?
Well, they said, this court must determine whether MOSORA imposes an affirmative disability or restraint on registrants. This court has previously held there is no affirmative disability restraint on the registrant, even though they're required to provide fingerprints, photograph, and written information concerning the offender and the underlying offense, because registrants are otherwise free to travel and go about their daily activities with no additional intrusion from government officials. And again, they cited Sanders. Providing a DNA sample and reporting in person does not impede the ability of the registrant to travel or go about daily activities any more than previous requirements. This court sees no reason to depart from our previous analysis. MOSORA is not an affirmative disability or restraint.
And then what about the rational connection to a non-punitive purpose?
The court stated factor four, Mosora's rational connection to a non-punitive purpose is the most significant factor, now that's the court speaking for them, in determining whether the statute's effects are punitive. This court continues to find registration requirements are rationally related to the purpose of public safety and protecting children from PFRs.
That's totally not really looking good for us here. Only one factor to go. What did the court hold in the fifth factor? And that is, did they find excessiveness with respect to the purpose?
Well, Doe contended that Mosora is excessive because Sora would allow him to seek removal. And he's talking about, SORNA. And he's talking about national SORNA would allow him to seek removal from the registry. The court held states are not required to adopt the exact same standards in their PFR registry scheme as laid out in federal SORNA. Federal SORNA leaves the intrastate sex offender registry to the states and concentrates SORNA's regulation on the national coordinated system, which identifies the interstate movement of PFRs. The ex post facto clause does not preclude a state from making reasonable categorical judgments that conviction for specified crimes should entail particular regulatory consequences. And they even cited Smith versus Doe at 538 U.S. at 103. The state's determination to legislate with respect to convicted PFRs as a class rather than to require individual determination of their dangerousness does not make the statute punishment under the ex post facto clause.
You know, I almost read in there, Larry, that it sounds like they have confirmed that there's not a federal duty to register.
They have done that. Anybody that listens to this podcast, and I pretty much can guarantee you most Supreme Courts and their law clerks do.
Really? You think so?
I'm fairly certain that they do. But there is no federal registry. It's a state registry. And they've said that in this decision here.
We shall move along then and bring in the heavyweight champion of California. And so we're going to go over this lawsuit that Axel filed against the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and the implications of this new regulation. So here we are with Chance's California Corner, the part of our podcast where we break down the legal issues in California and their impact on PFRs who live there. Chance, are you ready?
Absolutely. And Larry's going to jump in as well.
Fantastic. So we're going to discuss a significant lawsuit filed by AXL, which is the Alliance for Constitutional PFR Laws, but it's sex offender laws, or otherwise known as AXL, against the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, commonly known as CDCR. This lawsuit challenges CDCR's unofficial policy of retaining parolees in a treatment program for the entire duration of their parole. Chance, would you please give us a bit of background on the case?
Sure, Andy. The lawsuit was filed because CDCR had an apparent unwritten policy that required parolees to stay in treatment or in a treatment program for the entire period of their parole. This was despite the law, specifically Penal Code Section 3008 subsection D, which states that treatment should be a minimum of 1 year and can extend up to the entire period of parole, but it's not required to be coextensive with that parole period.
Well, if you say so, but and for many parolees, this policy wasn't a big issue because they transitioned to their maintenance phase of treatment, which might require monthly or even quarterly appointments. However, some parolees were significantly affected because they were forced to attend weekly for years and sometimes for the whole thing, repeating the same curriculum over and over again. And I've got some personal experience with that. They just regurgitate. They take the workbook and they reorder the chapters and you start at the same workbook all over again with slightly different iterations of the chapters. This could lead to miswork and disruptions in their lives. Could it not?
100% good. I've seen this happen to people. And then after Axel filed the lawsuit and overcame CDCR's demurrer, the CDCR admitted the existence of this unwritten policy and agreed it was inconsistent with the statute. Huh. Wow. When someone challenged it, they agreed that it was inconsistent. Weird. They also agreed to create new regulations to clarify a lawful policy and allows parolees to challenge unnecessary delays in their treatment progression. Chance, would you tell us more about these new regulations?
Oh, Okay, so here's where the rubber meets the road. The new regulations, expected by the end of September 2024, include several key points. Number one, a parolee's participation in a management program may be terminated before discharge from parole as contemplated by Penal Code Section 3008 sub D. The management program treatment provider will consult with the parole agent as to a particular parolee's termination from the management program based on the parolee's individual case factors. These consultations are solely to determine the length of a parolee's treatment in the management program and are independent of whether they should be discharged from parole. Individualized consultations between the treatment provider and the parole agent are contemplated in paragraph 2D, which should occur 1 year after the parolee has been in the management program, with additional consultations annually. These consultations should take place during the containment model team meetings. The treatment provider and parole agent's decision to retain the parolee in the management program must be supported by good cause as defined in Section 3000 of Title 15 of the California Code of Regulations, and the decision to retain a parolee in a management program must be stated in writing, signed by the treatment provider and parole agent, delivered to the parolee within 30 days, and maintained in the parolee's file. This is a huge step forward for parolees challenging the legality of their treatment requirement. It is advised to wait for these regulations to be issued and implemented. If their next containment meeting is after the effective date of the regulation, CDCR will have to provide a written document explaining why they are being retained in treatment. This document can be used as the basis for a 602 administrative appeal or habeas challenge, which is more effective, much more effective, than challenging the requirement without such information.
That's a great point, Chance. While it might set some parolees back a few months, having this documentation will provide a stronger foundation for their case. It's a significant change that could lead to early discharge of many parolees who have been unfairly kept in treatment, and I can vouch for that both professionally and personally. This is a game to keep people in treatment as long as possible.
Oh, absolutely. The case highlights the importance of challenging policies that don't align with the law and ensuring individuals' rights are protected. And by the way, the byproduct of this is not only finishing treatment up at an early stage, but actually being able to be removed from parole before the full time, since you can't be removed from parole until your treatment is over. So it's very beneficial.
I guess it's my turn again. And it's a reminder of the power of legal action and bringing necessary changes. Kudos to Axel for taking this on.
Larry, you've called this, quote unquote, treatment a collective fishing expedition. Why do you think that it is?
Well, because of the states that use the team containment model, you end up sacrificing all of your confidentiality, your what would normally be medical privacy. You end up with that team containment model glaring over everything. If you were hypothetically in a real treatment setting and you were having urges and you had not acted upon those urges, you should be able to go talk to your treatment provider about those urges, and your treatment provider should help you deal with those urges professionally. But that's not the way it works. Your treatment provider does do a consultation. They get on the phone as fast as they can, and usually they even work in the same building oftentimes. But they go tell your PO that you've had these urges, and then you find a pair of handcuffs on you for having these urges. So that totally nullifies the benefit of treatment. How can treatment work if you're terrified to admit any of your struggles? How would treatment be effective in that scenario?
Yeah, and you also sign a HIPAA, whatever doohickey, signing away that they are allowed to talk about your treatment with your PO.
Correct, and that's my biggest thing. If it were really treatment, the PO would get access to the information that you're fully participating, that you're being productive as a member of group therapy or individual therapy, and that there are no concerns that would rise to a level of what needs to be reported under the law. There are certain things that have to be reported. If you call the police and say, I enjoy watching the cute girls cheering at the football games on Friday night, there's nothing unlawful about enjoying that. If you call the police and you tell them, I enjoy watching the cute girls that are cheerleading on the football team for the high school football team on Friday night, and I follow them home to see where they live, then you've done something where it's actionable. You have the right to have a fantasy. Well, in treatment, people may be having fantasies, but they haven't acted on them. Wouldn't it be nice if we were really trying to protect society that they could seek help for those triggers before those triggers actually release themselves?
We need to watch Minority Report, Larry. We so need to watch Minority Report.
But you really can't. I mean, their attitude is, well, we'll go lock the person up and then we don't have to worry about the trigger. But that kind of diminishes the validity of treatment, because when the person comes out of being incarcerated, they're never going to speak up in treatment again.
Yep, absolutely. Chance, you were saying something? Pretty, I'm sorry.
It is pretty self-defeating. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, especially here in California, it's, you know, treatment has been ongoing for, you know, a lot of the reasons that irritate Larry for the entire period of parole. and it's done usually to defeat any kind of halftime claim that I've done it all. I'm finished. I'm good to go. I should be discharged now. And so, you know, it's used as a tool or a mechanism to keep a person on parole for the entire period and sometimes longer. And it's, you know, that's ridiculous. And there has to be some due process injected into this. And I think that this challenge is, shaking the tree a little bit. And an apple fell out called due process. And we're about to find out just exactly what that means come the end of September.
You were going to say, Larry?
Well, I was going to move on to the conclusion of this. And thank you, Chance. Great. That's a great segment, actually. This was very, very good. But we're trying to put together a case in Louisiana. And what I need to know from our vast Louisiana audience, I need to know about what it cost you to notify your neighbors through the requirement under the law. I'm trying to show that it can be significant if you're in an urban area, and I need to know what it cost you to run the advertisement in the paper. I'm guessing that a newspaper in an urban area would charge more for the advertisement. I'm trying to show the magnitude of what this is costing. So anybody in Louisiana that wants to reach out, please do, because we're looking at trying to put an end to this nonsense of you having to pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars to tell your neighbors that you're a PFR. And it's crazy. That's what the public registry already does.
I was just talking to someone privately about it. He pays, he's in a reasonably populated area, and he's got a bill of over $600. And I can't remember, does that come up annually? Is that every couple of years, or is that something you have to do every year?
I'm not sure on the frequency. I'm hearing different conflicting things, like 3 years, but it's the unpredictability to me is a constitutional violation, because every regulatory scheme, you can compute what it's going to cost you. We know what your license plate is going to cost you. There's a formula. We know what everything is going to cost you. But this, you don't know what it's going to cost until you get down to your newspaper, or until you find out how many addresses are within that zone circumference. It's an indeterminable amount of money.
He says it's every 5 years. Good grief, man. Okay. And if you want to, then you can just shoot an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com, and I will forward that along, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. If you're in Louisiana, like, I don't care who you are. Like, I don't want to know that your name is Bob Jones. I don't care. But I think your parish is important, and possibly, like, what newspaper is the distribution? Would that be fair, Larry?
Well, that would be fair, but I'm probably going to want to contact the people if they have anything good to say. So you're going to need contact information also if you're serious.
But, and that means you also have to then talk to Larry. So that could be good or bad, depending on your point of view. So. Chance, do you have any closing words?
No, just, you know, thank you for joining us, and it's been a pleasure. Very good program
Fantastic.
Today.
We are not here this next week because I'm going to the beach. So you all, if you want to record, you can record. I will leave the thing on. If you guys show up and record, that's okay. But we will be not recording. What is the date of that? It is the 24th that we will not be recording. And we'll see you in September. And is that right, Larry? September?
31st of August.
Oh, crap. All right, then. Well, head over to registrymatters.co for show notes. Leave voicemail 747-227-4477. Hey, back to that thing of the case. If you want to, if you are limited on what you can do electronically, please call 747-227-4477 and leave contact information, and I'll get the cranky curmudgeon over there to contact you back. And then, if you would be so very kind, support us over on patreon.com/registrymatters for as little as a dollar a month, and share the love. Gentlemen, I hope you have a fantastic rest of your weekend. Don't get too hot, Larry. Keep cool, and we will talk to you in a couple weeks.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.